I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Pete Rosethorne.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be here, Michael.
Well, it really is lovely to see you. It's another perfect Fremantle day, and you've arrived on your scooter.
I did, as I always travel around Fremantle in my trusty scooter. I haven't been knocked off it once yet. The clock's ticking. I always feel like that.
Well, I once had a scooter and I did get knocked off.
Okay, right.
And then the fellow wouldn't pay my scooter repairs bill.
Well, he can't eat well.
I had to get on the scooter and go.
What about your body repairs?
Did you get the quarter at 80 kilometres away to give evidence?
Yeah, they're a risky beast, but a beautiful way to travel around this area, and an area that I truly love, and I'll never move away from. I really love this area a lot. It's a fantastic place.
So, how long have you been a West Australian and a Fremantle person, Pete?
We married a West Australian in 1992, and we met in Melbourne. A shotgun wedding, and we flew across and we got married at the giant church in the city. What's that? No, St Mary's, isn't it?
St Mary's, the Catholic one?
Yes.
So there was top of the hill. The Catholics always get the top of the hill.
They sure do. It was a massive unit. I'm not particularly, didn't come from a very religious family, so there was 200 people down one side of the church and about 8 of my family members at the front, and it was all quite rushed. But it was, 27 years later, we're still there, and she's a Southern River girl, so she grew up in Riverton, and so there was never any thought of going to the northern suburbs. It was always going to be south.
Yes.
And Fremantle had been through. She used to work when the America's Cup was on. She was a beautiful 18-year-old girl. And used to, I was crewing some giant French yacht. I said, yes, I'm sure you were. But Fremantle was apparently a very electric sort of time, and I think early 90s it really dropped off a little bit and sit into a trough. But I think it's really coming into its bone again now.
It's got a feeling to it.
It has. It's got a feeling. It's on the move.
Let me ask you straight off. Mm. I usually ask people at the very end of these podcast interviews, what is it about Fremantle? And you've come here from t'other side. What is it about Fremantle that you think that excites people who love it and makes you pleased to be here?
It feels like you're somewhere else, if you know what I mean. So if you're in Melbourne and you live in Williamstown, you have a different perception of the city because you're on the opposite side of it. It feels like that to me. And it's also a seaport like Williamstown is as well. It has the mouth of the river, so you get that interesting thing of the world coming to you a little bit via the ships, and has the sort of village feel, and because the Italians were here for so long, and which is also very Melbourne-like as well, because they have a huge influence of Greeks and Italians. And I live in Beaconsfield, which is presumably old Market Garden not so long ago, and Spearwood and all around that area, and it just has a multiculturalism to it that you really feel, and it has a sense of that all these little cottages, especially amongst where you are, at that tight kind of living. And when I go to the South Beach Hotel, I see all the old photographs of when it was truly vibrant, where everyone was here, everything was coming through Fremantle to go into Perth. But it has a sense of that. Has a sense of creativity to it, because it seems to have had a life.
Yes, well, in some ways, everything old is new again. There used to be, of course, a tram that ran from the centre of Fremantle down South Terracea to South Beach, and people are back talking about running the equivalents
as
there
in Sydney. Let's dig it up again. The rails are going to be there somewhere. Yeah, but I certainly like South Fremantle as well. I think it's got a really nice mix of. It's got a really nice energy to it. People are coming to it and wanting to try and create something, which is nice.
It's a crazy place. It's hard to describe South Fremantle. It's a strange collection of buildings and people.
Yeah.
But speaking about strange collections of building and people, you come out of an entertainment industry. You come out of a performing industry. And how is it in your world in Perth in these days? I mean, is it... People talk about having a film industry here, is it?
They were talking about building some studios, because of COVID, but probably by the time they're building, there'll be no more COVID left. They'll probably be going to make films back in America and China again. So I like the idea of doing that, because the weather's fantastic here, and we've got apparently got beautiful light for it. But it's just to draw those big, what you need is to make it viable, is those huge, big American movies to be made, like a Baz Luhrmann style movie, which requires a lot of art direction, a lot of tradespeople, a lot of caterers. So we employ an incredible amount of people every time they're made.
Yes.
But you can't just do it once a year. You've got to be punching out 5 of those a year to create this big, viable, robust industry, which is from this distance.
And then another 5 the next year.
Yeah, that's right.
We could have a movie called Fremantle, which would be a bit like, was Baz Luhrmann's movie Australia?
Australia, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Work on it.
Work on it, Baz.
But you've been in a film or two.
I have, yeah. Look,
what was your first film?
The first film I did was a short film based on a whole lot of my family stories. I told a friend of mine and he wrote it up into a film, and it actually won the best the Australian Film Industry's Best Short Film Award that year. So I was sort of playing myself as a, well, how old was I? I was playing myself at 17, but I was 24, 25 at the time.
Yeah.
And it was just really nice to, we had a sort of a strange family. A lot of comedians have odd sort of, and say I had a violent childhood, but an uneasy childhood, in that my dad was a overbearing, sort of absent father. When he was home, he sort of ruled with a sense of unpredictability. So you didn't know what was going to walk in the door. We didn't get the good guy or the bad guy, or the, you know, the guy who wants to whack across the back of the head, or the intimidating guy. Or, so it was always unusual. So yeah, so comically, I found my feet just trying to find a way to get to diffuse tension.
John Mortimer wrote a book, I think, called Voyage Around My Father.
Oh, that's a great, that's a lovely
presented book. For other reasons, but not entirely dissimilar, that big presence in his life.
Yeah, that's right.
He dominated everything he did.
Yeah, yeah. And it, still to this day, my dad's a frail old, you know, 92-year-old man. I still go, still worried about what he's going to, you're right. All he really wants is a bit of a cuddle, I think. And
what was your next movie?
Oh, sorry. And then same guy who directed that, who thought, oh, I've won an AFI, I'll be able to get my feature film up now, almost straight away. It took him another, I think, 9 years, talking about the film industry being slow in Australia. So you go through all your funding bodies and jump through hoops, and he did a film called Crackers,
yes,
which Warren Mitchell was in.
That's the English actor, is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was an awful man.
Wasn't as bad as a character.
Yeah, it's like Alf Garner. Exactly. Like, you don't have to be Alf to us.
He didn't have to act.
So, but yeah, he was a good actor, but just sort of hard, you know. And that was released not long after The Castle, and The Castle had become an enormously popular movie.
Amazing,
and,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and we were sort of, I think, seen as some sort of copycat movie. We were poles apart as movies, very different sort of movies. And but that was always one of my goals, to try and get a feature role in a feature film. And I was ticking little boxes through all the way through my career. Yes. I just wanted to make sure. I never said, I'm going to be at Hollywood, and you know, by the time I'm 22, I'm going to be...
Might have been disappointed. Better to be surprised.
That's right. So I always set my bar to achievable levels, I thought.
So after that, what was the next movie?
Then I did a whole lot of bit parts and things like Takeaway, which was, I think, Vince Colosimo was in it. It was just a small sort of... And then there was Bad Eggs, the Tony Martin, Mick Malloy movie.
Yep.
Then I'd done, when I moved to Perth, I probably had the best run here, because it's a small town and you're a big fish in a small pond sometimes. Only because if someone's making, oh, who are we going to get to play, you know, the teacher? Oh, Peter Oastley, what's he doing here? You know, so Robert Connolly, who's a fantastic director, he directed things like Balibo and Boys, and had done a whole lot of very hard-edged movies, decided via his daughter to make a family movie that everyone could go and watch, because his daughter, there's no real life family movies, they're all cartoons, Dad. We should make a movie that's got real people in it, that's for kids. And he said, that's a good idea. So he did. So I played the teacher in that, which was all shot around here. Yes. And I did Ben Elton's Three Summers, which was down in Pinjarra. And I've just done, there was one I shot called I Met a Girl. A guy called Brenton Thwaites is in it, and he's a very good-looking boy. He plays Robin in the DC series in America.
Yes.
And he was in a film called The Gift. He's a striking-looking boy. Man, he's 28, 29. To me, it's like... But yeah, just beautiful. And so that's released the end of this year. And so, yeah, interesting.
So a lot of people won't immediately think of you as a moving pictures actor.
No.
They'll think of you in so many other ways. I mean, how do you describe yourself, if you have to?
I'd love to be described as an actor.
Yes.
Because that's what I love the most. That's what I love doing. I like studying process. I like working with other people.
Yes.
But most people would know me as a stand-up comic, so that's where I've been driving. That's driven my career.
I've avoided uttering the three words, Kath, and Kim.
Oh, don't avoid it. It's a gift that keeps on giving. I love it.
Well, it probably is one of the seminal television shows. And there was also a movie made out of that, wasn't there?
Yes, that wasn't great. That was Kath and Kim was at its best when probably its first series three, to be honest. It was really beautifully written because the girls had a lot of trouble getting it made. ABC wouldn't make it.
They said, astonishing,
no, it's not going to work, it's not going to be funny. And they said, no. We've done it before. They did it as a sketch in Big Girl's Blouse, which is a sketch comedy series the girls had. Magda Szymanski and Marg Downey and Gina and Jane had in the early 90s. And that's where the incarnation of the characters came from. And my character, Brett, was spoken about, but never seen. So
always off stage.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why I was on the phone a lot in the first series.
So, yeah. So a lot of people will want me to ask how on earth you were cast.
Yeah.
And approached. Okay. How did that come about?
A lot of it is not what you know, who you know, a little bit. So I had done, I'd started comedy in 1983. Glenn Robbins, who was Kel, probably started in 1982, same time as Jane Turner, probably started the same year as me, 83. So we became friends via the comedy world in Melbourne. And all of us tipped into television in the late 80s. So Glenn Robbins had done the Comedy Company and I had done the Comedy Company, and Gina and Jane were in Fast Forward, and then Glenn flipped over to Fast Forward a couple of years later, or Full Frontal, whatever it was called. And we sort of became, through that 80s period, the Melbourne Comedy Festival was formed. So all our peer group had formed the backbone of probably what's called an industry now. So it wasn't, there was enough people in a call industry when we started. So we're friends, basically. And I had done Gina Riley, who's married to a guy called Rick McKenna, who was the executive producer of Kath and Kim. He was the lighting and sound man at the first comedy venue I ever performed at. And so we've been friends ever since. And so from that, and working with them through that, what you want to do is have, especially when you're doing a comedy series, is have good synergy between the people, and everyone knows where everyone sort of pitching their character level, and knowing that who's running it. Like the girls ran everything, they wrote everything, and we just knew how to fit into that mold.
So you have to, in that sense, have confidence in each other. You know what your abilities, your limitations, your strengths are.
That's right.
But what about the character itself? Did you have to learn that from scratch? Was it invented off, on stage?
No, it was. I'm really good at reacting to things. I think it's one of my skills as an actor, is I'm a very good listener, and I can get characters to react really cleanly to. And Brett is a reactor because he's constantly reacting to Kim and the situation he's in. So in my world, I felt that I was kind of the audience. So I had to kind of, if the audience were going to be, you know, repulsed by something, I would probably be repulsed by it as well. So there was I work instinctively a lot like that. And I also look at what's happening within a scene and how the characters are pitching, and try and find room there that doesn't look the same.
Right.
So you're looking at something different all the time.
So does that mean, and I imagine if it does mean that, it doesn't always mean that on stage or on film or on television, that you are engineering and developing that role in a particular way according to your dictates, subject to the director and the writers telling you not to?
Yeah, the writers, that's where I love working for Black Swan and Melbourne Theatre Company things. So you get a script and the writer's done a job of writing something that's his or hers, and you should adhere to that.
You mean the words?
The words.
The words are there. Mm. But
and
when you read
the
a
words
novel,
will give you a lot.
They give you a lot, but you will still be, each of us who reads a book imagines the character possibly in a different way.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's where your own personal interpretation comes into. As long as you don't mess with the words, you will create your own version of what's on the page. So I did it's always interesting doing the same thing twice. I'd done a play called Laughter on the 23rd Floor, which was a Neil Simon play. It's based on the Sid Caesar show of the 1950s. And I'd done it with Gary McDonald, who, of course, was Norman Gunston. And,
yes, famous.
From Mother and Son, a beautiful
Nearly
man.
Nearly as famous as you.
Oh, yeah. I would love to be Gary McDonald. But he's a beautiful man and a great actor. And he played Sid Caesar in the first version I did with Melbourne Theatre Company. Then I did it over here, and I got to play Sid Caesar here. So, but his was far more, because he's a smaller framed man, it had a different completely different meters to what I did. We were doing the same script with same other characters.
You're quite a tall guy.
Yeah, I'm quite a big man. So he was a big man, Sid Caesar, and it sort of it sort of helps a little bit with the when he was so eccentric and he used his body to intimidate sometimes, you know.
Yes.
So if you haven't got that, you've got to find other ways to work it.
And I imagine people are cast because whoever's casting them knows what you look like, seen you on celluloid or whatever, and think they've got the sort of physical presence, mannerisms, whatever it is they're looking for.
That's it. I did an audition for very famous book, Jasper Jones. Jasper Jones. Yeah, I did an audition for that, and I was meant to play.
The author has a new one out at the moment.
Really?
Yes. A new edition, you'll find it looking at you when you walk in.
Okay. I was going to do the film down there. It was down in Pemberton. I was meant to play the town mayor. And I did an audition, and the woman saw me when I walked in. And she went, oh. Because she just thought, comedian straight away. And then I did my bit, and she went, oh, you're sort of a chameleon. You change shape like a lizard.
Which is what you want to hear.
Yeah, and I went, oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you very much. She said, yeah. You'll be great. So it's funny because you do actually.
Good movie, Jasper Jones.
Yes, it was great, and I regretted not being able to do it, but it was. It's those sort of things that you sort of you fear a little bit in terms of holding you back. Like, you know, I'm not going to get him to do that because he
is. Is it that fear that one is typecast, whether it's as the comedian or the stand-up comic or the. In those various, or just as a television actor, and you can't become the actor that you fully want to be.
Yeah, it's a bit of that in it, and also, but you're always, I reckon, one performance or something away from something magical happening to you. Like,
yes.
Like Jackie Weaver is a great example of that.
Wow,
did one film, did Animal Kingdom, and just went boom.
And suddenly,
away she went. It was incredible.
The woman we all knew was suddenly everywhere.
Yeah. And working with the best in the world and doing a great job. And you know, it gives you a heart because you go, oh, well, she looks as skilled as Robert De Niro, as whoever she's standing next to. You just go, wow, it's just about the opportunity sometimes.
The proverbial overnight success.
Yes, that's right. That's 60 years.
But overnight successes do take all that time. We're constantly reminded of it. And you're no longer just the young man. I mean, all of us grow older, and people who knew us when we were younger just see that young person. They probably still think of you on comedy.
First
episode of Kath and Kim or something. Some years ago now. But how did you get into this game? Were you someone who drove the family at home mad because you insisted coming out into the lounge room every Friday night and performing something? Or did you crack jokes at the table? Did you drive your confreres at school crazy because you didn't shut up?
I was never a class clown, but I had great timing at school. I know that I could make a teacher laugh. I knew when to say something and kind of what to say at the time. That came from the home thing I was telling you about, my father being a volatile man. So you would pick your moments to try and get in there to ease tension.
You needed timing.
You needed timing. Otherwise, you got right across the back of the head. So there was consequences with poor timing that hurt.
And bad jokes, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that never goes away. And I remember being at one, you know how it was very rare. I don't know why we're doing it, but sometimes the families got together in our street in Mount Waverley, and they'd have a little barbecue or something, and the kids put on a little show. And I remember being tiny. What would it have been? I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. And I was dressed as a woman. They dressed me up as a woman. And I slipped and fallen over. And, you know, my dress had fallen, coming back over my head. And everyone laughed. I remember that. I still remember the excitement I got from everyone laughing at that point, even though it was a misfortune.
I thought you were going to say being in a dress.
Yes, hello, darling. I've done plenty of that too. And I just love the excitement. I never forgot the excitement of it. And anyway,
so did that develop into something? I mean, did you get sent off to acting school or something when you were young? Did you start appearing in productions?
I did it on the sly sort of thing. I joined the St. Martin's Theatre Group, which was connected to Melbourne Theatre Company, when I was 12. I said, Mum, I want to join this group. And she said, oh, well, why do you want to do that? I said, well, I'm just interested in drama and things. Like, oh, okay. Because it sort of came from left field. They didn't sort of pick it.
Yes.
And so I just took myself on Saturday mornings and did that. Then school had a little bit of it, and then it sort of dropped away. But I was doing school plays and musicals and stuff. And I remember my dad, I did quite well in my year 12 musical or play or whatever it was, and Dad didn't speak to me for about 2 months because he thought...
Yeah. So did you have a singing role in a musical?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I sang.
What are some of your first memories of that?
Oh, what was the first musical? Oh, the first play that I tortured my parents through was Caucasian Chalk Circle.
Oh, that will have excited just about everybody there.
Done by year nines. Oh, torture. Oh, God. And I had one line in it. It was right near the end. But, my parents sat through a lot of stuff that was...
But you're doing that. We can perhaps talk a little bit about technique and what you get taught early. But but you finish up training to be a drama teacher, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. So I was terrible at school and repeated my last year of school. And because Dad said, do what you want, you've got to have a proper job. So you've got something, get a degree. Don't care what it is, just get a degree. Good advice. So I did, I started doing drama teaching. And whilst I was at drama school, I started doing comedy at night because this friend of mine, Toby Hines, who was a daggy kind of kid, but he used to impersonate the noises of trams and buses and stuff in his bedroom just quietly. He decided to take it public and went to a comedy venue, and it was amazing. People loved it because he'd say, okay, here's the number 72 tram crossing Camberwell Junction, and it do the noise of the tram.
People go,
spot on! So I thought, well, if he can do that, he's got balls, I'll do that. I can give that a crack. So I got together with a friend, we started busking, and then we got booked in these comedy venues. And
At that point, or not necessarily that point, but at some point, did you suddenly think, well, I'll follow Dad's advice, I'll get this certificate, I'll get a job as a drama teacher, and spot other kids who might be talented. Where you thought, no, I've got it and I want to do this? Or did, like the Jackie Weaver example, was there something that happened that then said, right,
this is it? That triggered it. I became good at comedy quite fast, and the comedy scene was expanding in Melbourne quite quickly.
Yes.
So I did a show called Let the Blood Run Free, which was an improvisational sort of thing, and it got into one of the bigger venues in Melbourne.
Yep.
And then I thought, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be famous at this. Mm-hmm. So I deferred my drama teaching thing.
Right.
Then I did it for about 2 years, and then I realised, it just doesn't go anywhere. This stops after one job finishes. That's it. You've got to restart again. It's not like you imagine it's going to be one job rolls to another, and that's going to go to that. So yes. I went back and finished my teaching degree and got that
well done,
back
Pete,
pocket.
Said Mum and Dad.
Yes, thank you. And then the comedy company started the year... after, yes, it was the 1988.
88.
Yeah, so a comedy company that started, and I got offered the comedy company, Fast Forward, and the big gig, all within 1 week. So I just chose one and went away. I went.
So just stay then with this proposition for a minute.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, as you say, sitting on the outside, you assume that people in your industry are faced with all of these things, having to make a living, wanting to succeed, have to balance these. Do you have an agent? Do you have someone sitting there saying, look, you can only take one of these three?
Mm-hmm.
All of them are probably going to be good.
Yep.
Or can you somehow manage to say yes to everything? Although that might be dangerous.
Yes, that's right. And but when you're young, you say yes to everything. Except I remember my friend, a guy friend of mine called Jeff Payne, who was who'd come out of VCA, he'd started studying with me, then he went to Victorian College of the Arts and was going to become a proper actor. And he left and he got offered Neighbours and he said, no, I'm not doing Neighbours. And I said, mate, you've got to take Neighbours. You're an idiot.
They hired Jason Donovan, didn't
they? It's one of his great regrets. I would have been there now. Paid my house off, had some fun.
But doing pantomime or something.
Yeah, that's right, and earning 50 grand every month over Christmas holidays in Britain. But I was just the first cab off the rank. I was headlining in Melbourne doing comedy. And I'd done character acting via the Let the Blood Run Free thing and other things that see me do. And I think I was great. I was well shaped to go to one of those programs.
Yes.
But I just chose the one that offered the most money in the end.
Now,
wow, how much?
The dentist, from as far back as I can remember, always had Wednesday afternoons off to go and play golf.
Okay.
Probably a lot more, and a stereotypical view of an actor is they probably sort of must have got up early, late this morning or early this morning, whatever.
Yeah.
But do you have to develop a completely different, work program in order to, do you shoot early, do you shoot late, do you sit around doing nothing for a lot of the time?
I kept myself pretty busy for that sort of, that initial period, because I was obviously working comedy at night and studying during the day, so I had a lot on my plate, and then I realised, because I was doing the comedy work, and I was learning much faster on a performance level as well.
Yeah.
So when I deferred it, like I said before, went back to college, I found it extremely easy to do the college work and work at night.
You were highly motivated.
I think so. I just loved being engaged in something I loved. I loved doing it. I always felt, well, it's adrenaline. It's full of adrenaline, it's excitement. So, and that just kicked me. The only time I felt like it was a job and it was just my career was when I started having children.
Ah. Now,
that shifted the dynamics.
Now, we're not here to talk about relationships, but I am interested in knowing when you're trying to have a career and develop a career in your field, in comedy, and you're getting into acting and wanting all these things to happen, and then relationships come along, how do they fit? How do you fit the relationship with? How does your partner fit into this? It must be a challenge at times, because you've got a busy time, you're meeting your own schedules.
Yeah, it's really hard. We met, and like I said before, it was a shotgun wedding, so we were thrown together very quickly, but we lost that baby just after we were married, really. And so that was a really big learning experience for us, and we got much closer because of the disappointment of that. Mm-hmm. Consequently, lost two more babies after that through pregnancy, and I just knew that we were very tight as a couple. Mm. We were a very good couple. And I'd been a bit of a floozy up until that point. So I felt very settled in it. And Gabriel was never, we met, she was pulling beers at a pub in Melbourne. She'd left her dad, had passed away here, and she'd gone to Melbourne to sort of escape and start afresh, I suppose, and met me. And so when our kids were little, we would go on tour. So I was doing Rocky Horror Show then. So we would go to Melbourne for anything, go to Sydney and go to Brisbane, then it'd stop and I'd do some stand-up for a while. And, and so all based within the cities we were in. The only time it became a tripping point was when school started. So I'd moved over to here then, and I'd done Rocky Horror Show really through that period. I bought a house and then we're on a tour for most of the time. Then school kicks in and suddenly I was like a FIFO and we'd had a second son.
Yeah.
I made a kid series here called The Gift, and we'd done Crackers, but I think we went to Melbourne for it. Yeah, we did. And so it was 98, I think, school started. So it was really tricky. That became, she was a full-time mum and wasn't working, and has been that way ever since. She's been a full-time, had both parents at home. It's been a fan. That was another thing that I loved about my career. I could shape it around my family.
Yes.
And that's the importance of doing stand-up comedy in the corporate world. Yeah. So I can fly off for one night and come back.
Yeah.
And I'm making money doing what I love doing. Yeah. Those jobs are quite difficult, or can be. I'm just still doing what I love to do and being very present at home.
Yes.
Because of the family stories I was telling my family, my father's volatility, I wanted to be the opposite. I wanted to be very present, and I wanted to be very... stable.
Well, Pete, it's what you've just shared is very touching. It's quite emotional. You've though remained in love with what you do.
Yeah.
Just go back to comedy for a minute.
Yep.
Can anyone do comedy? I think I know the answer. Can anyone do comedy? Can any performer do comedy? Where does it come from?
Like, everyone can sing, so everyone can be funny. There's terrible singers, terrible comedians. So that kind of, but I think...
Terrible comedian may not be a comedian.
That's right, yeah. The trick is to be really, to have longevity within it. You can't be talking about bucket bombs when you're, you know, in 50 in front of a crowd for the BHP mob, you know. you just go... Well,
it's not going to work.
Not going to work, mate. So a lot of people have a trouble getting out of that. So all my comedy is really generic. It's very broad. It's extremely wide. It touches upon, I do a lot of work in Perth now, so I touch on Perth quite a bit and my relationship to Perth. And
take it from what you've said, although this goes without saying, I imagine, you need to know your audience.
Yeah, very much so. And that's part of the skill. You can read an audience quicker.
Yes.
The more time you have in the game, you can sort of look at something and go, okay, how far can I go? it's, and those sort of skills take years to kind of learn.
Yes.
And it's...
Are there, was there a point at which you came to appreciate that, I don't know what the right word is, but let's use the one our parents probably would use in respect of us, that there's a point at which you achieve some level of maturity in all of this, where you thought, boy, I realise the journey I've been on, where I've got to, and what I've learned.
Yeah, I think I've only just got to that. I'm 57. So I think I'm now walk onto a stage, just in virtually any environment, probably not live television. So if I was asked to host the Logies, I don't think I'd feel comfortable.
Yes.
But most of my work is in, you know, I'm not intimidated by the western suburbs of, you know, Perth
anymore. Anywhere.
There's times where a room full of rich people used to scare me. Now I just go, well, you're just people. I can make anyone laugh.
They've accidentally made money.
Yeah, that's right. Some of them. Most of them. But yeah, so it's, and it's getting over fear. It's 80% confidence.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Were there times when you bombed? You hear about comedians having to bomb, sort of thing, to learn the ropes.
Yeah, and you never stop bombing. There's times where you just don't. No, there can be, it can be a victim of the environment, and they can't hear you or see you, or you're just the wrong tone of person or comic for that environment. You know, you're not what they want to see. That's where the corporate thing becomes more tricky, because you put upon an audience, they've not come to see you, you're sort of there.
Yes.
And they go, oh, I want to see them.
You've been hired because someone's seen you do a corporate before and they think you'll be perfect for that.
That's it, yeah. And suddenly you're not. But also, you know, I can go from, like, I don't know, where was I last week? I was standing in some office in Forest Field, the guy makes parts for drills, and you know, just people standing around having beer, and I'm just doing my thing, and I leave. Then I go to the Crown Palladium, and everyone's in black tie, and there's 800 people there, and it's all hoi polloi, and the minister for there, and this minister, and you're doing exactly the same thing, pay the same amount of money. It's what you do. So I'm quite comfortable in my own skin now.
You mentioned that you're 57, and the thing that has struck me about your career and others like you is that you just didn't come on the scene and burn out. You've plainly had this love for what you do. You're an actor, and you can act in all of those different ways. And here you are. You're still here. You have to be resilient in this game.
Yeah, you do. I think the love of it drives you, but also if you do good enough work, you will get kicked through the system.
Yes.
I think I've had some really big breaks, you know. Being on the Comedy Company was a big break at the time. It was a huge television program.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, it really sort of created some modern comedy in Australia.
Yeah, it was an observation of our suburbia.
Yes.
So you've got Kylie Moe, got Con the Fruiter, and Uncle Arthur, and old people. And, you
know, yes.
Little kids, and you've got lots of just social comment.
You're making me laugh people. Just starting to think about
it. Yeah, it's lots. and then, of course, I just happened to be involved in the next biggest observation of our suburbia, which was Kath and Kim, which was really connected me to, it's so, women love it. Women love Kath and Kim a lot. And their daughters watch it, and their daughters see their mothers, and their mothers see their mothers' mothers. And now, because of Netflix and TikTok, we're trending on Netflix. Look at young teenage girls going, "You're Brad." I go, "I don't know how you recognize me, but congratulations." Yeah, so it's a gift that keeps on giving. It's a beautiful show. And it's going to sit in the up there as, you know, one of the greatest sort of sitcoms of our time.
It absolutely is, and it must be wonderful just occasionally to reflect that that's me. I did that.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
And what about your family, close and further afield? Do they treat you kindly and nicely?
Oh yeah, they're extremely proud of it all.
Yes,
which is really nice feeling. My brother was a business person, and he was in the same sort of business, like logistics, like my father was in after he'd left the sea. Anyway, my brother was always, didn't want to be seen as Peter Rosethorne's son. And then I got on the television, "You're Peter Rosethorne's brother." He was going, "Good."
I would imagine he'd be very pleased. It would suggest when you're involved in business that you've got some other creative bones in your body.
That's right, yeah.
Not just who you seem to be.
Yeah. I think my parents always worried. They've got past it now. Dad's still, it was weird, you know, when the GFC hit, I went and got my truck driving license because all my work disappeared, you know. I had no work for the whole year, just stopped. So I went, okay, what am I going to do? So I panicked a bit. So I went and got my license. So I knew my brother would employ me somewhere, one of his stupid ass trucks. And my dad was blown away by this. So I'm proud of you. Getting a truck license is bloody great. Jesus, I've been doing this shit for years. Doing what I love. You know, throwing my name out there. It's the first time he's actually ever said, I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
It's really odd. But he's proud. I know he's proud of me for all the acting stuff as well, but he always worries. He's going, when are you gonna get a real job? It's kind of what he's always had in his head. Gotta get a real job. Damn, I'm 57.
I've been doing it. A couple of well-known Australian authors, writers, wrote to a Commonwealth parliamentary inquiry, I think, recently, talking about how people in the arts aren't appreciated, particularly during this COVID time.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, we don't wear bright vests and we don't hit things into the ground with hammers and so on.
That's right, yeah.
We write and so on. But how has, from your perspective, and looking more widely amongst your colleagues and associates, the COVID period affected things?
Everyone pivoted, went all Zoomy. Everyone's gone very Zoomy.
Gone Zoomy. Yeah, I was just on Zoom before you got here.
Yeah, there you go. So that was, so as part of the pivot was, what are we going to do? When I did the trucking thing, they did a story on Flashpoint. Flashpoint was very good to me too. They got me through having just a weekly little
bit. This is on Channel 7.
It's on Channel 7 over here, nowhere else. They showed them my trucking story, and they broke it up into a news piece, and it was, I didn't know, but it went national. So suddenly Sunrise going, come on the show, talk about your trucking career. It's inspirational. So I was known as a trucker. It was, hey, you're still trucking? Oh, geez. So
keep on trucking.
Yeah, because of that, Mineral Resources called me, and they said, you can help us. We've got a whole lot of, you know, workers stuck in their dongers out there. They can't go to the gym. They can't go to taverns. So maybe you can create some kind of web program for them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. Really, so we were doing this. Yeah. And I was talking to Glenn Robbins or Dave Hughes or people I've worked with in the corporate sort of world, you know, speakers, you know.
So you became like a webinar.
Yeah, that's right.
To people who are stuck in dongers somewhere.
Yes, and I did it for two different companies. So that got me through the worst of it. And because we live in the luckiest state in the world, well, I was... Yes. Performing publicly again by July. So all my Melbourne friends are still there.
Still in still up
still
down
Zooming. Yeah, still, I said, can you do my show? Yeah, yeah. I'll chip in and help out there. But it stopped everything. Like, you know, event companies.
Yes.
It's amazing how many, the kick-on effect. And event companies are part of the, you know, the artistic world.
Yes.
And they kick on to me and bands and everyone. And
Pete, we're getting close towards the end of our discussion, but you've been part of this sort of, in a sense, new wave of Australian comedy, Australian television, and everything that's flown out of it. Do you ever fear that our cultural legacies are going to be wasted? Are we going to be dominated by the Americans or BBC?
That's always been the fear. But I think there are some laws in place where we have to create some Australian content. And I think via the new platforms, I mean Stan or Netflix, there's going to be an Australian branch of all those things. And there'll be things that are made. I think there's more channels now for you to get something up and try and get it on than there were when we were just dominated by the four TV stations.
Yes.
Or trying to get yourself a film, you know, a feature film made, which is extremely difficult and still is. So I think in that way we're in a slightly better position. Whether we're going to lose sense of, see, our culture's shifted quite a lot because we're such a multicultural beast now, where things like Kath and Kim may not be produced as a sole, you know, five white people in a white person house.
Yes.
there's no integration of any other colour in that series.
No.
We had some Aboriginal dancers, Steve Page was on it, and there was a little bit, but it was really for long before it was funny.
Midsummer Murders suffered this fate at some point.
There you go. Yeah.
Yes. The other question I'm always interested in, I'm talking to a whole range of photographers recently have had wonderful careers, and they started out in the newsrooms of newspapers or doing an apprenticeship with a professional photographer. A lot of these things no longer exist.
No, that's right.
Could you get into what you've got into today? What would your advice be to the proverbial 17-year-old?
Okay, so
I've
got one, my daughter, my third daughter, our third child is starting comedy. She started at 16. She said, oh, what's my pathway? I said, well, come with me to the club and you go on doing the tryout bill and the amateur nights and get up and you start. The only thing, the way to learn is to do it. There's no course you can go to. But what it will help you do is give you the courage. If you get good at it, it will fling you in other directions. So I've got, via comedy, which is total self-creation. I don't wait for things to come to me. I never really have. Things come to me, good luck to me. But I have never gone, why aren't I working for Melbourne Theatre Company all the time?
Yes.
I'm a great actor. But you've got to go out there and keep yourself active.
Yes.
You know, there's a million festivals around Australia now you can get on board. All it is registering a venue. Like, you might do it in a boat shed. I'm going to try and do a play in a boat shed in Fremantle for the festival.
Yes.
And suddenly you'll get 20 people there watching you do something that possibly very average, but you've created something, written something, performed something. Don't wait for it to come to you. Go to it. So that's my advice to anyone, is go to it if you can. She's going to do a TAFE course next year, because it's a radio TAFE course.
Yes.
Because what we've found out is that it's a very proactive TAFE course, and it'll throw you into a job somewhere, or they'll try and give you a job attachment after, and she wants to, because she likes the idea of being on radio. And stand-up comedy is another great thing to have in your back pocket if you want to do that medium.
Yes.
So I think there's plenty of pathways if you want to find them.
Right.
But I think a lot of people go, I've got to go to Whopper.
Yes.
And if I don't get in Whopper, I don't know what to do.
End of the road.
Yeah. But that's always been a psyche that thinks always existed. There was NIDA years ago, before Whopper. NIDA was mine. I've got to go to NIDA.
Yes.
If I don't get it, I'll go to VCA.
Well, Bill Gates never got his certificate, I think.
There you go. That's it. It's all self-qualification, isn't it?
Pete, we'll finish up, but it does make me wonder if you've got a motto that follows from all of that about life and being determined. It sounds like it's along the lines of you just never give up.
Keep on keeping on. Yeah, I just like, and stay in the game. I love staying in the game.
Staying in the game, that's it.
Yeah.
Pedro, Rosen, thanks very much for talking.
It's been a pleasure, Michael. Love talking about myself.